netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hello, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. It's June, and that means it's Emmy nomination season, with the announcements of the finalists coming next month on July 17th. To that end, for this podcast, we're focusing on a television series that could very likely garner nominations across several categories, and that's the most recent Star Wars series, Ahsoka. Our guest this week is Richard Bluff, who served as visual effects supervisor as well as co-producer. He and Mike, of course, talk about the visual effects for the series, including the great work on the Purrgils, but also have a really interesting discussion about virtual production LED volumes and their various reasons as to why and how they're used on a production. Richard has a lot of great insights, having used it extensively on The Mandalorian, as well as this series. So it's a really cool part of the podcast. So let's join that conversation now between Richard and Mike.
So firstly, congratulations on the show. Obviously, we've spoken to you before. Obviously, we've done a bunch of stuff. But I just want to, for people that are listening, your CV covers such great things. I just want to like touch on it for a second. Like, apart from the obvious stuff that you've done, which is The Mandalorian and the stuff that we've spoken to you about in the past and Boba Fett, there are things like Elysium and Lucy, which is like a huge, I just love that film to death, and even The Big Short, which I love to death. Like, it's quite a range of stuff, but wow, some of those, I mean, I'm just touching on a few highlights from stuff that you've done, but it's a heck of a run there.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So, but recently, in recent times, you've been focusing obviously on this world that we're talking about today, Ahsoka, and obviously Boba Fett and Mandalorian. It seems to me that, like, I think you did almost all of The Mandalorian and 9/10 of Boba Fett. Am I right? Like, you've done...
I did season one of Mando. I split season two with Joe Bauer.
Right.
I did all of Boba Fett. And then I didn't work on Mando season three because I was doing Ahsoka.
And on Ahsoka, you've got a credit as a co-producer. And I believe you visual effects supervised 7 of the 8. Is that right?
I supervised all 8. I can't get IMDb update with the 8th, unfortunately.
Okay.
Yeah,
I was curious about that because, yeah. So, just setting the stage there, what's different about being a co-producer than being a visual effects supervisor? Like, what does that actually involve?
I think for me, it was helping the newer heads of department and some of the newer creatives that joined Ahsoka that didn't know how we worked on the Mandalorian shows, which of course Dave had been involved in from the very beginning. It was helping to be a conduit between the creative that Dave wanted to achieve and those departments. So running interference and kind of pulling folks aside, talking them through the process, how we wanted to work. And then of course, any sort of concerns that they would have that they wanted to kind of discuss, that involved visual effects, they would come and talk to me. And oftentimes I'd pull a meeting together with Kerry or Dave or whomever else to try and, solve the particular issues. But a lot of times I was running to set and, communicating with departments, and it might not have been a visual effects sequence, just to make sure again, that they understand what it is that we were doing and the kind of Star Wars show that we're making, because we're making so many right now. And oftentimes the execution can be done slightly differently depending on the creatives. Dave is very particular about the kind of show that he wanted to make. And I knew, I'm very close with Dave and I work with Dave for a very long time now to know exactly what it is that he wants to achieve. And, I was always kind of stepping in to try and help make sure that we were achieving his vision.
Okay, you mentioned Dave a few times there. Let me jump straight onto that then, because this season really goes further back to the Clone Wars than anything else. It's the most kind of personal for those of us that know Dave's journey because of Clone Wars and the whole development of this character. Can you talk to that? Was that always something that you knew about? Was it a surprise to you that you're going to be going back in these kind of I'm not going to say time jump, but we'll get to that in a minute.
We always knew, and I always certainly knew. And one of the things that I always kind of tell people is when we were making Mandalorian season one, Dave and I spent almost every evening together kind of talking about the show, talking about how we were working. He would talk about what he wanted to do when he eventually brought Ahsoka to live action. Obviously, she appeared in season two, episode five, but he was always planning on writing a series. And a lot of those ideas that he spoke about back in 2018 were ideas that the were in this show, and he never deviated from those ideas. So I knew very, very early on, years before we started production, the kind of show that he wanted to make and the kind of things he wanted to see.
So obviously no spoilers, as the show's been out for a while, but the episode where Anakin is front and center on the, what I don't know, you'd call that the dream bridge, what was the name of that you had for the...
Yeah, the world between worlds.
The world between worlds, there you go. I mean, this, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. It was an absolute fan favorite. It united at so many fronts. It had so many interesting aspects about it. But as I say, one of them is this idea of going back to the Clone Wars, sort of recreating effectively significant events in the Clone Wars, but in obviously live action, and with a younger version of the characters. Could you talk to that?
Yeah, what was interesting about that is again, it kind of goes back to the way that Dave works, and particularly how closely he works with Doug Cheng. Dave always had a very, very clear idea of where he wanted to go with that particular story, and the visuals that he wanted to have. He kind of wanted the environment to almost appear like a memory. So he didn't want a lot of clarity in the background. He wanted to kind of to kind of just kind of fade off into the distance, almost like you're in a first person, or you're being taken back and remembering a particular moment in time. But your peripheral vision is hazy, and so it's really all about the kind of the foreground and kind of what's happening. So that was represented in the artwork very early on from Doug, and that was something that we were very keen on. And making sure we replicate it, because you know it's everybody wants to make the best looking images on screen, of course. And you know, when anybody's kind of lighting a big vehicle that's exploding in the background, you're going to want to see all of that, and you think you can do the best version of it possible. But knowing exactly what Dave wanted to do, we wanted to almost show the visual effects artists what it is what was the world that they were going to drop their characters in and their vehicles in the explosion. So we wanted to achieve a lot of it on set. So we did a lot of tests early on with the DP leading the charge, trying to figure out how we could fog up the sets. Did we need blue screen? Did we need green screen? We ended up going with gray screen because we kind of just wanted everything to kind of fall off and try to get as much in camera as possible. Obviously the lighting instruments on set as well was something that were very important to Dave in terms of kind of triggering all the explosions. So when you actually see the before and after, yes, we're adding in a lot of the CG vehicles in the background and a lot of the digital characters, but we weren't really changing the lighting a lot or the atmosphere. It was kind of what was there on the day, and we were just making we were kind of playing with shapes and silhouettes again, kind of falling into this idea that it should feel almost dreamlike in a memory and not very clear off in the distance.
Yeah, but if we talk about some of those large vehicles, they're very big transmissive volumes that you've got, and obviously because of the explosions, they're illuminated transmissive volumes, and so you're placing stuff really in those elements in a way that, you know, I mean, I don't know if it was that primarily sold by replacing and CGing or just a depth mat with some kind of tricks in compositing, but it's beautifully done, but it's like they're big spaces, much bigger than you could have got on the soundstage.
You're right. And it was a challenge going into visual effects, how they were going to achieve that. And so it was Enrico that kind of worked with his generalist team, and what they did, they replicated in CG what we were doing on set. So they got the atmospheric volumes kind of working and lit appropriately. So then when they rendered out the vehicles, they would have all of that depth information. A lot of it was kind of put together in the comp, but they made sure that they had an environment that kind of matched as much as possible what we had on set. but there was very little of the environment that we actually shot that was being thrown away. It was really a lot of delicate augmentation in comp from matching the lighting and matching the environments, matching the atmospheres.
So if that's at the large scale for the wide shots, obviously pivotal to these scenes is that there's blaster fire and lightsabers, which are both incredibly important narratively. But, you know, you don't have the contact lighting of two lightsabers hitting on set. So how are you solving that?
You know, that's actually one of the trickiest parts, I think, about these shows is really how we treat the lightsabers. And again, you can kind of look at different Star Wars movies and the different shows, and it might have been done differently for various for very particular reasons. But Dave had a very particular idea of how he wanted to create these. And so a lot of times with the lightsabers clashing, we obviously do have the lightsabers lit on set, but the flashes are usually one frame at most, two frames max of kind of doing a flash frame and then kind of carving out illumination onto the characters. But even then, it's pretty subtle because as soon as you start to kind of overwork the plate with artificial lighting on top, it starts to kind of fall apart a little bit. So it's a little bit more just almost going back to kind of what works in the original Star Wars movies, where, you know, you had these kind of odd green flashes that were over the lightsabers. We were kind of doing a modern day version of that.
I think you're being a little modest there, because on the, I'm not trying to contradict you, of course, but it just seems like you got really great contact lighting of some of those flashes wrapping around the characters, which in a way I really appreciate it. It wasn't just a flash. It was like contact lighting that sort of enveloped the characters. I mean, unless I'm I'm sort of second guessing you, but it just seemed really, really gorgeous the way that happened.
It's no, true, and there were occasions where we would do match anim on some of the characters just for those moments, just to kind of get a better contact point when we knew it was an important story beat. But a lot of times it was just more kind of comp finesse that was kind of over the top and subtly done. So your kind of mind starts to play tricks on you as to how much work we're actually putting into the bulk of the shots, but really kind of focusing on the shots that you're really paying attention to.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking in particular on the bridge in between worlds section, especially at that, those more aggressive battles where you've got this lovely sort of light and dark, yin and yang, light side, dark side thing going on with Anakin. But he's so aggressive, and the lightsabers being hit by his lightsaber just produced a lot of light that was very readable on the close-up nature of the actors.
That's true, and I think there was a lot of work done practically on set to just make sure that the lighting values were subtle, but they read enough. And there were moments when they were goosed practically on set for those hit moments, and then dialed back down again when the kind of lightsabers went away. Because the Dave and I have a similar aesthetic with lightsabers, when all of a sudden, when people are kind of walking around with a lit lightsaber, oftentimes there's way too much light being thrown off them sometimes. And we kind of wanted to play it much more subtle on the show. But during those fight moments is when we really kind of played with it to try and make sure you felt the danger and the proximity.
Yeah. I mean, on the, so away from the Clone Wars sequences, back on the, what I'm calling the bridge, Was that just on blue or green screen? You weren't on gray screen there because you didn't have the same atmospherics there, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we were on a green screen. It was always a raised platform, and it was a grated floor, so the DP and the gaff could kind of get light from underneath, because that was really important. Knowing that the CG version, the bridge that we were going to be adding, was going to be illuminated on the sides. We did quite a few tests of, you know, where we needed to put the light to make sure you can kind of feel it underneath. And obviously, a lot of times when the camera would drop low, we were doing leg replacements on the characters because they would get occluded by the footbridge that they were on. But of course, it needed to be transparent in the show.
Yeah, and of course, you even had their very footprints sort of lighting up on the surface as they walked and moved and stuff. So it was very interactive.
Yeah, and that was something that was from Rebels. We'd seen what they'd done in that particular show, and again, we always kind of, because obviously there are shows that Dave has developed, we were always paying attention to what they were doing. And before kind of Dave really kind of drilled into exactly what he wanted to see, we knew broadly what we needed to achieve. We would kind of come back with versions that would kind of replicate what they were doing in the animated show, but trying to make it as photographic as possible. And oftentimes he would want to throw away certain elements or certain ideas because he felt like that was too akin to an animated show and wanted to kind of drive something slightly different.
So Hayden, the actor, is, you know, great actor and a good looking chap, but he is like 42 or something, 43 years old now, right? And we needed him to look younger. Was that makeup? Was that digital? Like, how did you do that?
Well, that was interesting, actually, because going into the show, there was an expectation that we might have to do something involved like we did on past shows. But the reality was that when Hayden showed up, he looked great. When he kind of came through, you know, hair and makeup, or we did the lighting tests, the way that Q, the DP, and the gaffer was kind of lighting that scene, he looked great, in all honesty. And so we really pulled back on the amount of cosmetic work we were doing digitally. We did do some. We were getting rid of some of the age lines, but nowhere near as much as we have on kind of past shows. And there was a number of shots in the whole sequence that is Hayden one-to-one. And so we just really kind of focused on those close-up moments, particularly when the lightsaber got close to his face. Because oftentimes just the way that the light is kind of coming directly underneath, it can be unflattering to anybody. So in that particular instance, you could see that he was older than the character we needed to portray.
And because, as I alluded to earlier, there was this sort of light and dark side, evil versus good kind of thing going on, which is, I mean, from a narrative point of view, was brilliant and gave us both the endearing kind of Anakin and the Vader Anakin. But were the eyes treated at all in the negative dark space, or was that again just makeup?
A few times, yeah. That's right. A really good spot. So he was wearing the Sith contacts, and there was a couple of shots where Dave felt in the DI that you weren't quite reading it as bright as you would need to, just to kind of reinforce that moment, particularly as you pointed out when it kind of fell into kind of the shadow. So we did in the DI, but it wasn't something we needed to hit necessarily in visual effects.
So moving away from that brilliant episode for a second, well, actually, I think it's the end of that episode, but anyway, one of the things that was brilliant, beautiful, and must have been a bit of a jaw-dropping moment for you was space whales. I mean, it's just, I have an image of you sitting there with a cup of coffee, you know, turning the page and it like reads space whales and you go, wait a second, is that a typo? And it works on screen, right? But that's a heck of an ask because, like, it's something we know, it's something that has a fluidity and it's flying. And not only that, it's sort of intergalactically sort of zooming around. Like that could, it didn't, but it could have gone horribly wrong in terms of just being comical in a bad way. How close was what you produced to concept art? Like, do you have any concerns there? Because it's beautiful, especially like the earlier sequence when she's making contact.
You know, it's interesting. You frame it pretty much exactly the way it was. And I think that Dave is very well aware of images, characters, or scenes that he wants to take from the animated shows and bring it into live action. I think he's aware of what might be challenging. And so even before he wrote the episodes, when he was just outlining, every now and again, I'll get a text from Dave and he'll tell me, get ready for so-and-so, get ready for this. He just wants people thinking about that, particularly myself in the visual effects. So I remember him bringing up the Purgles very, very early. And it almost became a stick he would poke with. So where are you with the Purgles? What are you thinking? How you think we're going to do those? And, but, you know, I have, you know, complete faith, particularly in Doug's art team, to kind of give us some spectacular images to work from. And that's really where a lot of the original heavy lifting kind of came from. You know, when you read the scripts, it was a beautiful scene to read. And then I couldn't wait to kind of see the designs. And as soon as you saw the designs, and, you know, the issue that I felt was always going to be scale. It's always going to be scale, and the motion, the speed of the motion. And, you know, you can know what the pitfalls are, but if the filmmakers don't appreciate that and want to kind of push in a particular direction, for whatever particular reason, it can be an uphill battle. But it wasn't from the get-go, because Dave understood that, Doug understood that. So all the imagery that we were seeing were really kind of referencing blue whales. So you'd have all the kind of markings that you would see on a blue whale, whether it would be a scar that would be kind of healed over, or barnacles, anything kind of like that, that would kind of give the idea of scale. That was in the imagery. Now, Doug's not going to give us, obviously, motion. So one of the first things we did was modeled the asset to match the artwork. And of course, we did receive a model from Doug's art group. But the first thing we did was Hal Hickel and Paul Kavanagh started doing animation tests with ILM and started getting the motion in there. And of course, we're doing wedges of various different sizes. And very quickly, it actually came together. And as soon as we started showing the turntables of the creatures kind of moving, and Rico suggested, let's get some clouds in there, because everybody understands how big clouds are. Everybody understands how fast clouds can move. And as soon as we started getting clouds in there with the Purgle, we always had a Star Destroyer next to the Purgle or a ship as well, again, to kind of give you those size cues, because they were always going to be next to a ship, generally speaking. It kind of came together really well. And I think from that point on, it was just making sure that the in particular, the animators really understood the aesthetic that we were going for, the TDs with the lighting, of course, as well. But it was,
yeah, scale was the thing I was going to ask you about. Scale, because of a whale being obviously huge scale, except for when you put them in outer space with a planet behind them and they're like dots. But I guess not only were you placing ships, but there were some beautiful close-ups. I'm thinking of that eye shot in particular, which was just somebody just did some beautiful rendering on that sucker. You know that close-up eye shot I'm referring to?
There's one particular moment I think you're talking about where the Purgle flies past the engine, and the lens in the eye kind of catches the light. And that's, you know, the fun about working with artists. That was an artist that just decided to, he knew that knew that the look dev, of course, had all those geometry layers in there where you could kind of catch that reflection of it. So they just did it in the shot and threw it over towards us and said, you know, see what you guys think of this. And we obviously, I mean, it's beautiful, showed it Dave straight away. And again, that's when everybody brings their A game and everybody is enjoying the show. And the everybody just raises the level of the show, and that's what's fun. That's what's really fun is giving those people opportunities.
Yeah, no, it was beautiful at so many levels. So I wanted to ask you, just from a production point of view, as we started mentioning your great work with Mandalorian, which is now iconic even in popular culture for the LED volume and the era that it in. Did you use LED volumes here, and if so, where and how?
We did. The LED volume was a stage that was utilized throughout the entire production. And with that, of course, there's a certain amount of throughput you have to use with that stage. And so there was many, many instances where the LED volume stage, I thought, was invisible to the audience. It certainly was to us, even when we just got the dailies through. So, for example, a good example would be episode 8. When Ahsoka, Sabine, and Ezra ride the howlers into the fortress and the door kind of slams behind them and they arrive in that main kind of foyer area, that's on our LED volume. So all the walls are on the screen. The stairs that they go up are actually physical in this stage. And then there's a physical wall behind there as well. So I felt that worked incredibly well, because the in that particular instance, we were using the wall as basically a digital set extension, and it's not providing the too much of the lighting on the characters. There's not a lot of ambience required from those walls, and you don't have the inverse square issues that you have in other environments. But that was one of the really great uses of the technology on that particular episode, I felt.
Were you using it for any of those exteriors on the planet when they were out, or was that on location? Because that's where the inverse square really...
Yes, the vast majority of the work on Peridia was on our backlot under a silk. And we did obviously set extensions in every single direction for every single shot from photography brought back from Scotland. But there were a number of scenes that we shot in the volume the initial fight with Sabine and the bandits in episode 6, I believe. And there was another scene when she meets the Noti for the first time in the riverbed as well, which again was always going to be a challenge. We obviously had the puppeteers in there, but you certainly have a big challenge when you're trying to create that infinite sky dome above, kind of lighting the physical set, and then also having the set extension on the wall as well. So we continue to learn about what works. But in those particular cases, everybody was happy at least with the process.
Because you've been front and center over the evolution over what seems like a while, but not that long, I guess, in real terms, of the LED volumes, are you finding that there's a shift? Are you getting more final pixels in camera, or is it there been a trend to or from having like an isolated green screen just behind a character's head? I'm just wondering, in the general arc of the work that you've been doing, is there a trend that you're noticing with the way that the directors are working with the LED volumes?
That's a great question. You know, we're always at the mercy of the filmmakers and how they want to work. And I think we've done some pretty incredible work where you're getting, you know, the vast majority of the sequence in camera, which is what it's intended for. And there are other sequences, of course, where the in-camera finals are less important and it's more about the controllability of the lighting. If, for example, you're shooting at a sunset all the way through. And then there is a lot of work that is done simply to continue to experiment, to see what does work, to continue to kind of push the boat. You know, a lot of the work that John wanted to do in season one with big animated characters on the wall, so actors can kind of can play off of that. We weren't ready to do that in season one. So as the seasons progressed, even though it doesn't necessarily present itself as being the best case for in-camera finals, there are other reasons why the filmmakers want to utilize that technology. For me personally, you know, I've got to the end of all of these seasons and the vast amount of work that we've done in the volume, and I kind of feel like where I know where the sweet spot is, but that's just from my point of view. And again, everybody's different, and you know, DPs will certainly throw in their two cents and gravitate towards the controllability of a particular light, despite the fact that the wall might then need to be replaced later. So it's always been, you know, a push and pull between all the different departments as to why. And obviously the production designer, you know, the production designer might not necessarily, they might not be able to build that entire physical set that's required, even with digital set extensions, and therefore a partial set and then an LED extension is something that can communicate to the filmmaker, can communicate to the actors, but is not such a big of a lift.
So with your producer hat on for a second, as a rule of thumb, and I don't need actual numbers, but just in terms of cost, I guess there's like two ways you could think of it. You'd say, oh, well, we don't want to have to build this big elaborate set because it's only going to be used in a couple of shots, or and thus use an LED volume. Or you could say the other way around, it's too hard to get all these amazing, you know, environments done for just a couple of shots to have ready for the wall. So we'll have to build some stuff and set extended later. You know, as a sort of a general rule, is it more cost effective or to go which way on that? Is it on the like less shots, or if it's like, oh, I've got a whole lot of shots here, so now it's worth engaging the volume?
I kind of think it's a little bit more involved than that. Because I think there's been some spectacular use cases where we've sent a photography team to Chile and then they've come back with a sunset or a rock and it might only be 12 shots and it's all in camera. And the value there for that particular scene, even though it's only 12 shots, is huge. Because also as well, it sets the tone for the rest of the sequence that might be on the back lot, that might be a set extension. So I think there's lots and lots of different reasons why you would and why you wouldn't.
Has your evolving relationship with the virtual art department, because at the outset with Mandalorian, of course, before you did that, you know, on set, if you had a fairly good idea what the environment was like, that was enough. You might show people even on an iPad or something. But, of course, once you go to having the possibility of using LED volume, you need to have these environments much more integrated into the pipeline. And so the whole idea of virtual art department has to have evolved a lot. And I just wondered if you could speak to that, in your experience over these shows.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's absolutely critical to have a virtual art department, but beyond just the idea of kind of developing the imagery and scouting a set and putting it on the wall. For me, I think that it goes beyond that, because there's an exercise, of course, of if you create an open plane environment in Unreal or whatever it may be, and the idea is that you then kind of, as we used to do, and it's in all the demos, you used to take the LED volume as a cookie cutter and you kind of slice it through the environment. And then obviously everything that falls outside of that cookie cutter would be projected on the walls, and then you build a physical in the foreground. It's never been as simple as that. And even when we were doing Mando season one, we talked about the idea of what you actually really needed to do instead of building this open world environment and get lulled into what that could feel like in the volume. What you actually needed to do is, as you drop that cookie cutter in there, you need to render a 360 camera from that middle, and you need to project from the CG walls back into your set. And you also need to put a lid on it, because that's what our stage looks like. And so even though that the DP is heavily involved in lighting that open world environment, what they need to actually do is once they've rendered that 360 and they put it on the actual wall, and then they light from that image-based lighting into the physical set, again, all in Unreal or wherever else, then the DP then needs to light the physical, the set in the middle by poking holes in, but adhering to the holes and the access points that they actually have in that stage. That's one of the biggest gotchas with this technology, is that everybody can put on headsets and everybody can look at these environments and go, well, that's amazing. And they are, they're beautiful. But there's a huge leap from then projecting it onto these LED walls and understanding whether it's actually going to work or not. And I think that is something that we worked and continue to work really, really hard on, to make sure that we continue to make the right choices. And again, it's not a right choice of visual effects, it's a right choice for everybody. Because for me, I was always involved in particularly after season one, helping the new heads of department to understand what the day was going to look like, and all the episodic directors as well. Because all of a sudden, they've been coexisting with these artists in this virtual environment with headsets or whatever it may be. But let's actually show them what the day will look like, because that might not be the way they want to film. Or it might be the opposite. It might be the perfect way that they actually want to film that particular scene. And that's been a huge improvement for us.
Yeah, just extrapolating on what you were saying, and if I'm understanding correctly, I mean, I guess in one sense, if I took a perfect snapshot of an environment and put it on the LED walls, and then a DP walked in somehow magically not knowing what was going on, they'd effectively be walking onto an unlit set, because in a sense, if it's perfectly matching the environment, it's like walking out into a field. You wouldn't just walk out into a field and say, right, well, we're just going to film without anything. You'd immediately be thinking about scrimming suns or, you know, putting extra lights or everything else in. So perfect replication of a natural environment that's been created in Unreal or whatever is, in a sense, only your starting point. Is that what I'm hearing you saying?
Absolutely. And I think the other thing as well is that, it's the example I always give, right? So our stage in the LED volume is circular, just for simplistic sake. And if you put a column in the middle of that environment, and let's just say that column is supposed to be out in the middle of a field, and let's say you get a photograph of a field, and it looks completely photographic to your eye, and then you put the column in the middle, maybe the lighting looks pretty good, and maybe you can actually manipulate the ceiling to throw more ambient light down on that to kind of replicate the film. Maybe kind of behind camera, you're pushing some light on it as well. Then you replicate that column. And then you put one to the right, one to the left, one to the right, one to the left, and you get closer and closer to the wall. The lighting on that column is going to completely change, of course, is because it gets closer and closer and closer to the light source. And so that's something that the virtual art department needed to evolve to, is you might be creating a wonderful looking environment, that we can then get on the wall, and then we can up-res and get it more photographic with more time. But should it be on the wall? Because there's going to be physical objects in the middle, and how are they going to receive light from the wall or anything else? And so that's the next step, is synthesizing the volume with what that creative is to make a better choice as to whether it should be there at all.
Yeah. And presumably also, I mean, Stagecraft now being as well developed, and that's the crews working with it. I mean, if I was lighting a car, a real car, I'd often have difficulty with reflections because it's a reflective object, right? Now, the brilliant part about what you've done with the volumes is you can have, especially Mandalorian's helmet, you can have shiny objects and they're no longer a problem because they are reflecting it, right? But that being said, you have the ability not just to say, I need to block out that reflection from a tree, you know, move that entire planet out of the way because it's giving me a bad reflection. And then you've got that problem of how much do you artificially make a dodgy world? I've been on LED volumes where the trees are up in the sky because they just were a good place to get reflections on the windshield. And at some point you're like, have I broken realism because I've done something really dumb, or is just having trees up in the sky, the audience doesn't know, and if the audience buys it, it's okay. I mean, there's got to be a kind of a, you could bend it so far that it's no longer looks real and it's hard to put your finger on it, or has that not been your experience?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I, you know, it hasn't necessarily been my experience with the Mandalorian shows and Ahsoka, but other shows that I've done with LED volumes, the filmmakers understand that it can be flexible. And so what you end up doing is, a lot of times, is you're creating an environment, and you're creating a photographic environment, and let's just say, for the sake of argument, you're actually collecting data from the real world. So to all intents and purposes, it should be photo real. And you play back an environment, let's just say you're moving through it. But then all of a sudden you get to the point where so much control is being asked for of that environment on the day, whether it's, can we push these buildings away? Can we push the buildings up? Can we add more stories to the building? How tall could that skyscraper be so it appears in reflection, or whatever it is? Then all of a sudden you move further and further and further and further away from what is real, to the point where oftentimes there are conversations that I have, which is, if you weren't doing it in the volume and you showed up on location and the sky wasn't cooperating, you'd still shoot the show. So let's make the best looking imagery possible, but let's not compromise the quality of the imagery and the potential believability in camera, because you think you might need all this flexibility on the day, because 9 times out of 10, they don't. They look through the lens, they see the image, and they craft from there. What they're not typically doing is kind of undoing everything and relighting and changing everything. I would say that some of the most success we've had, just going back to Ahsoka and the Mandalorian shows, is when we put photography on the wall. So way back on Mandalorian season one, when Greg Frazier and myself and Andrew Jones and others, we were doing our initial test to kind of greenlight the show with John. We had a whole host of tests coming out of Unreal. And some of the stuff that Greg and I both wanted to do is, we wanted to put images on the screen. We wanted to put a lat long of Death Valley, or a location that you could believe is Hoth. I personally went with Enrico, and Enrico developed a 3D environment that was based upon photogrammetry of a room, the famous Angel Island test, which was completely photoreal, but it had parallax. And those were by far the most convincing things that we ever put on the screen. And nobody ever wanted to change them. And nobody ever asked to change them, because they understood them to be real. But as soon as you create a world that's kind of synthetic, and most Star Wars shows need to be because they don't exist, and you put them on the wall, they believe they need all the control and flexibility to tweak on the day to try and get it as real as they possibly can. Because at that point, it's not post anymore. Everybody's involved on the day, and everybody's got a point of view as to what they think can help make it look better. And that's a challenge. And that's, honestly, it's the fun part of the project. And it's where we all kind of really get to collaborate and work together.
Yeah. I was thinking also, as you were talking and saying that, it must be a liberating thing for the production designers and the costumes and wardrobe, and even standby props for that matter, because once you go into these volumes, you no longer, well, you can't have that because it's green in your green screen, or you can't have that because it's going to reflect, or et cetera. So you're obviously working with those other departments, but they must also be enjoying the freedom that they're providing because it's so collaborative.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, what was a huge eye opener to me on Mando season one was the fact that, you know, Amanda, set decorator working with the production designer, to your point, if there was a green screen behind there, she's not going to be doing the set decorating. And then all of a sudden, let's just say, you know, 15 months forward, she sees the show on TV, and it's like, and you know, visual effects artists have gone in and done a layout of what the props should be in the background, the hangar or whatever it is. And she might think, I wouldn't have done it that way. I would have done it this way. If I had that set, I would have done it differently. And chances are, with experience that she has, or anybody in her role has, it would be better, because so many choices are left to visual effects in post. Not everybody wants those choices. The people want to make the best looking thing. And if somebody would be working with me in post and say, hey, maybe kind of lay out the props like this, or the lamps or the crates, it's collaborative, and chances are it's going to be better. So for her to be involved in the process with many others, with props and costumes, all of a sudden it does raise the bar and it does improve it. I mean, we did have the costume department helping to clothe the digital doubles that went in the backgrounds. And it does make a difference. It requires a huge amount of work to organize that and to factor that into scheduling and making sure that everybody, you know, has sign off. But I honestly think that's why we did have the success we did.
I think Stargate's been really successful, not least of which is because it just has production value. It just has the sort of non-compromised, gorgeous footage from wherever, whether it be LED volumes or stagecraft or just straight visual effects. It doesn't feel small, and it doesn't feel backlotty or on a stage. I don't know. I'm not saying that any of the other shows do, but this one in particular just felt to me like it was quite open. I'm wondering how you'd characterize it.
I do. I still think there's more that we can do. Because oftentimes, even when we're on the backlot, we still do have challenges backing our camera up and getting more space. We didn't go to Scotland, which was the location for Peridia, with a main unit or a second unit. We went with a photography unit. For me personally, visually, there's always more we can push. And I'm sure everybody in the show would think the same thing. We all want to kind of make it better. But to your point, it was something that we discussed throughout prep. How do we make this feel big? Knowing that we want these environments and these characters to kind of live beyond this season in whatever form that may take, we wanted to make sure that he had scope. And so it was, again, checking ourselves against the way that we've done things in the past and things that we've learned. One of the big changes that we made, and it was during production, was for all the exterior, for the vast majority of exterior work on Peridia, we were waiting for, we had the scripts. We knew that the howlers, the beasts that they would ride around on were going to be a big deal. But we hadn't gotten into the previs. And we were waiting really to understand, well, how many shots are going to fall into each kind of difficulty category to know how we're going to solve the howlers. We knew that we were going to need a kind of motion-based work, but did we need a proxy? Do we need people on horseback? And so there was an idea that was in the back of my mind from the very beginning that we might need to have horses. And I had conversations with the producers on the show and Dave and we kind of left it until we saw the previs. And as soon as we saw the previs, like, okay, we need people on horseback. There's no two ways about it. So from that moment, I met with the producers and production designer. We kind of walked the back lot and we talked about, well, we need horses in the back lot. This whole thing needs to be silked because it needs to be overcast. We need to control the lighting. We need various access points for the horses in and out. And that really kind of turned upside down how we were going to do Peridia. And it was all because we wanted to make sure the scope was as big as we could make it. The Western Wagon Chase, as we called it, the sequence as big as it could be, and then the vistas could be as big as they could be. And then, of course, we sent people to Scotland to capture as much of the environment there as possible to bring back.
Well, yeah, as I say, I love the season. I thought it really had air space in a good sense, air, if you like, around the characters that that really resonated. And then, of course, it just had these charming moments of actual performances from the actors, which delivered some total fan favourites. So without geeking out on the fan favourites up too much, it was a really good season. So thanks so much for taking time to talk to us about it.
No worries. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it, as always.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast. As always, we appreciate having our guests like Richard take the time to chat with us about their work. In case you missed it, a couple weeks ago, we had another podcast covering a likely Emmy-nominated show, Loki Season 2. Mike caught up with Chris Townsend, VFX supervisor for the series, and you can find that episode on the FX podcast page of our website. Well, that's it for this ep. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.